be cold, so my voice is not as melodious as it ought to be, and I ask your forgiveness for that. I give you a little information on my background. I have been born, as you can see, a long time ago in Germany, as you can hear, and in a little town in Bavaria. It was a very beautiful town called Bamberg, and has a cathedral that was built in 1100 and still stands and is still beautiful. It has an emperor and his empress buried there, and has a pope buried there. Has a very beautiful sarcophagus for the emperor and his empress, carved in ivory with scenes from their life. And the town is a had about 50,000 people living there when I was there, and had an archbishop and had a priest seminary and a convent. And I would say 90% of the people were Catholic. And when I was 13, well, let me start with my family. I was the only child of well-to-do, loving parents. My father owned a factory and employed 300 people. And they brought me up with a lot of love and attention, and didn't spoil me rotten, I hope. But when I was 13, in that convent, which until then only had taken parochial students, a new class was opened where you had to have an average of at least 95 in order to be accepted. And then you could take a six-year course in which you had 9 years of Latin, 9 years of English, and then when you were 18, you were passed a week-long test, you were automatically accepted at any university in Germany. So I went to the convent and I got a very good education there with mathematics and physics and chemistry and the 9 years of Latin and 4 years of French and 9 years of English. And this was still before the Third Reich, and therefore things were still going smoothly and happily, and I had a very happy childhood. And since this class only started with me, I was the only Jew among maybe 200 students, and everybody was very nice, and I had a very good time. And then, of course, in 1933, the Third Reich started, and things took a very drastic change. Until then, we had felt quite assimilated and accepted German Jews. My father had fought in World War I, and my family goes back to 1700 in my hometown. And so it was a very painful awakening that suddenly we were the Jews and nobody wanted to say hello to you anymore. Your friends disappeared very fast, the non-Jewish friends. And I was still in school, and also, knowledge was not very much fortified by the Nazis. They wanted the girls not to have a higher education, but to have babies. And therefore, when I graduated, and with 14 Catholic girls, out of whom only about 8 were admitted to universities because of the Third Reich. Without the Third Reich, all of us would have automatically been accepted anywhere. So then, this was 34, and then I took some courses in Italian and some other things, and in 36 got married, and my father took my husband into his firm, and he did all the export travel for him, so we got pretty good connections to foreign countries, which were very helpful. We had Danish friends who had immunity because they were diplomats, and they smuggled most of my jewelry out to Copenhagen. And we tried, of course, to get out, but it was very difficult because the United States had a very long waiting list until you were called to the consulate, and you could figure by your number how long it would take. So we tried to get into Sweden, and then in 1938, was the infamous Kristallnacht. I don't know whether you remember, it was the 9th of November, and in Paris, German diplomat had been murdered by a Jew, and the Nazis took that for a reason to burn the synagogue and to invade Jewish homes and break whatever was breakable, including crystal. That's why it's called Kristallnacht. And they arrested all the Jews, the men were brought to the local jail and the women to the Gestapo headquarters. And they kept us there for a day, and then they sent the women home, and the older men were sent home. And the younger men, including my young husband, were sent to Dachau, which was a concentration camp. And of course, you never knew whether you would ever see him again. You couldn't communicate. And I tried very hard to get him out. And I called our Swedish representative, who was a Christian Swedish citizen and who tried to get us into Stockholm. But he was a very correct gentleman, and if he didn't have a visum, he wouldn't say he has it. And I needed something saying I have a visum, otherwise I had nothing in my hand to get my husband out of Dachau. So the phones, of course, were tapped, so you had to be very careful what you were saying on the phone. He spoke German. And I called him and I said, I need a letter that we can come to Sweden. And he wrote that he would be very happy if we come and would take care of us or something, but not a word about a visa. And his typewriter worked the same as mine, and there was enough room between his last sentence and the salutation. So I added on, we will provide the visa. And that was a decisive factor. So I took this letter and went to the headquarters of the Gestapo in Munich, greeted by a 6'5" SS man with dogs this size too. But they let me go to the right office and didn't harm me in any way. And I presented my paper and they took note and they said, my husband by then was part owner of my father's factory, that they wanted to sell the factory to Aryans, and in order to do that he had to be released from Dachau. So they took note of it, and I was very pleased with myself that I had done something to get him out alive, until I came back home and got a phone call from the local Gestapo, from the chief of the Gestapo. I could immediately report to him, which I did. And he greeted me, how dare you go over my head and go to Munich? Why didn't you come to me first? And of course he was right, and I didn't have any good answer. And I got frightened that he could have killed me for that, you know. And this is the only thing I could think of. I broke into tears and told him I was stupid and hadn't thought of it, and I was upset about my husband, etc., etc. And he was, as far as I guess, Gestapo chief can be decent, relatively decent guy, so he didn't behead me. And he saw to it, and really after 4 weeks of, if you excuse the word, H-E-L-L, but there is no other word, my husband was the first one to come out. And for 2 days he told me all the things that had happened there, and he usually was an introvert, but there he couldn't stop talking. This was November and early December of 38, and they had to stand for hours and hours outdoors at attention, wearing only prisoner garb, pajamas and nothing else, and of course everybody got sick. And he borrowed from somebody a scarf, which was risking his life. If he had been caught with the scarf, they would have killed him. But without the scarf, most likely he would have gotten pneumonia. So he was lucky and nobody caught him. And he said when they entered this concentration camp, the head there greeted them with the word, two things are ruling here, the whip and the gallows. And that's about how this place was. And then he came out, and then we did get the visum for Stockholm about December, and then tried to get German passports in order to leave, and had to make long lists with each item we owned in order to have permission to take it out, including silver, whatever there was. And when we got it back, they had struck off every piece of jewelry besides the wedding ring, and one set of silverware, but not that's it per person. And for each piece of furniture or clothes or whatever we wanted to take, we had to pay the full price of what we had paid when it was new, because it was only 2 years old, and therefore they claimed it was new, but we did. And then when it came, so we got the permission to leave, and then you pack all your goods into a very big, like a very large wooden box, and about half the size of this room. And the guy who, they sent an inspector to watch that we didn't pack anything that wasn't on the list. But he was a relatively decent guy, and he told us at 12 o'clock he's now going out for lunch for an hour, And of course we packed whatever we could, like silver things and all my silverware I got in that way. And we got out of Germany all right. My parents and mother-in-law were still left, and we tried, of course, later to get them out. And we got to Copenhagen, where we had the Danish friends who gave me my jewelry, and then to Stockholm. And first had a furnished apartment, and then rented a larger apartment, but then our furniture came, and we hoped to get our parents out. And we were in Stockholm on a transit visa, and therefore not allowed to work. But if you have very little money, you cannot exist. And my husband secretly worked anyway, and I stayed home and learned Swedish and forgot most of my English. And we had planned to stay in Sweden and change the transit visa to a permanent one, which could have been done with the right people pulling the right strings. But this representative was eager for us to do it. But then Norway was occupied, and Denmark was occupied, and Finland was at war with Russia. And we were very much afraid that we wake up one day and Sweden would be occupied by the Nazis. And there was one night when they tried it, but somehow the king, who was a very decent king, got wind of it in time and avoided it. So Sweden stayed neutral, as you most likely know, but we didn't know. So we decided, by then our number came up, to go to the Swedish consul and get our visa for the United States, which we did. Spoke beautifully Swedish with the American consul, because they'd forgotten some of our English. And then we had booked on a ship from Stockholm to New York. And by then, of course, England was at war with Germany, and the Atlantic was mined. And my husband came home one day with a little leather pouch on a string, and gave it to me, and I said, what is this for? And he said, that's to put your jewelry in case your ship is sunk, at least you have your jewelry. And I said, if I'm floundering in the Atlantic, I don't give a hoot for the jewelry. And he couldn't understand that. I was suddenly so disinterested in the jewelry, I said, I'm not going that way. We're going instead from Stockholm, Moscow, Japan, to Seattle, and then New York. It's a long way to get here. And that ship actually was sunk coming from New York to Stockholm, so we really hadn't missed much. And so in August of 1940, we flew from Stockholm to Moscow, and it was very hot when we arrived in Moscow, and people didn't wear any makeup and were very unstylishly dressed, and looked at us because my husband wore a tie and nobody else did. Nowadays many people don't, but in 1940 anybody usually did. And we had to pay for the whole trip in and through Russia in Stockholm in Swedish money. And we sold most of our china and anything in glassware and lots of things because we couldn't pack it and pay for the to have it shipped again from there to this country, and also we needed the money to pay for the trip. So even from the airport to the hotel and meals, everything, I think we never saw a ruble. Everything had to be paid in advance in Stockholm, and then we got all the necessary papers. And there was only one hotel in which we were allowed to stay in Moscow. But otherwise we were free to come and go. We could walk or do whatever we liked. Nobody bothered us, I think. And it was all done by interest. And included in all the money we paid them was that they give us an interpreter for the trip from Moscow to Vladivostok on the Trans-Siberian Railroad, because at that time Russians didn't speak anything but Russian. Of course we didn't. And so one day, on the first day we arrived in Moscow, that guy from Interist came with my husband and me to show us our room or something, anyway, in the hotel, second floor. And on each landing sits a middle-aged lady in that hotel and watches that no hanky-panky is going on. So when she saw me, of course I was young in 1940, disappear with two guys in my room. She immediately followed to see what was going on, and then we very happily told her it was all legitimate, and she disappeared again. And we walked around in Moscow and saw lines for the ballet and lines for the department stores and lines everywhere. and we ate well. And then, of course, there's the beautiful subway, which we had a guided tour, and they showed us the subway, which is all marble and very beautiful. And so on the second day, we decided to use the subway, and there was a permanent agrarian exhibition, which is a little bit like the World's Fair was, where each section of Russia shows what they produce, which can be anything from furs to coffee beans, because part of Siberia is very warm and fertile and grows oranges and coffee and lots of things we didn't know. And Mrs. Vizay was there this year, and this exhibition is still there, and it's a little more modern, but basically still the same thing. And wherever we went, we saw out of flowers about 15 feet high, the faces of Lenin and Stalin, and we stood in line to see Lenin's body is on display, and people stand an hour coming from all over Russia to see him, and then you walk by and you sort of wonder, is it real or is it a wax figure? It looks more like wax, but basically it doesn't make much difference to me. And anyway, we and then on the subway, of course, very difficult if you can't read where you get off. And in Russian, I can't read whether it's first stop or third stop, but we knew third stop you get off, and so we got to that exhibition and got back again, and it worked out all right. And then after those 3 days, we entrained on the Trans-Siberian Railroad, and we wanted to save whatever we could, so we traveled third class, and were very happily surprised when we saw we had a compartment with sleeping for ourselves. And with us was an older couple from somewhere else in Germany, first class, and they had a Russian soldier and a Russian girl with them in their compartment, so they were not doing as well as we did. But about 3 days out of Moscow, our interpreter said we were stopping somewhere for an hour or two, and he's getting off, and he will mail any letters we had mailed if we give him some money for the postage, which we did. And everything was fine, only we never saw him again. He left us sort of, we were on the train, but we had nobody to speak, to interpret for us anymore. And we were sort of thrown on ourselves. And next morning, they came with a very nice Russian menu for breakfast about 10 in the morning. And I just pointed to something, hoping I get breakfast. And I wound up with roast goose, which was not exactly what I had expected. And the waiter had the most dazzling smile you've ever seen. He had all silver teeth, and that was at that time the most stylish thing, and he was so proud of it. He was smiling constantly from beginning to end, and we made friends with some Norwegians who had a little money, and also they piped propaganda from morning at 9 or 10 in the morning until 10 at night, spoken. In every compartment, you couldn't avoid it, you couldn't turn it off, so this Russian shouts at you all day long. And but we were young and had fun anyway, and one of those young Norwegians found out that in the middle of Siberia we had a wedding anniversary, and managed to present us with a very lovely layer cake with white icing, and this is a vodka term. Pour it in here and comes out here. And we were dancing in the ice and we had a real good time. And then we came to Vladivostok and stayed 3 days in Vladivostok. And I don't remember very much besides cobblestone streets which hurt your feet. And then we embarked on a little ship going to Japan. And to my great surprise, when I went into our cabin, there were two young male Norwegians whom I had met before on the train and were very friendly with, but not friendly enough to share my cabin. And I said, excuse me, this is my cabin. And he said, oh, this is ours too. And the four of us shared that cabin. And then we got to Tokyo, and we had meant to stay there about a week. And I disliked everything I saw. That was a time of the Axis. The Japanese were very friendly with the Nazis. They didn't like us. And before we got to Tokyo on the train, we had 2 hours stop over somewhere, and all we were maybe 10 Europeans, and we decided to have a little food. It was 5 in the afternoon, and it was a little village. And we walked down the village and without thinking anything, and out of each house came those Japanese, and they looked at us as if we had three heads or four heads, I don't know, and were breaking up in laughter at our very strange appearance, which again didn't endear them very much to my heart. But we got something to eat and went back and got to Tokyo. And Tokyo, this was August, had terrible humidity, which I had never encountered, because neither Sweden nor Germany has humidity, and it was worse than here. They had tiled floors in the lobby of the hotel, and they were constantly wet from the humidity. I saw my first fist-sized cockroaches, and even though the Japanese are very clean, but those things were there. They give you very nice kimonos, and they give you slippers, and they had a nice room, and I felt very unhappy, and said to my husband, let's take the first ship out of here. And we did. We stayed only 3 days, and then got passage, began third class, on a Hikawa Maru, which was a rickety Japanese ship, and we were, one day hit a typhoon, and I was sure it would fall apart, but it survived. And there we shared a cabin with six other people. One elderly lady with her two grown-up sons, and a couple with their very pretty 17-year-old daughter, and my husband and I. So I usually fully dressed went into my berth and closed my curtain and then shed a few things. But those two men never did. They left everything open, and there they were. And my husband's berth was on top of this very fat, older Viennese lady, and she had been already one night before us on the ship. It came from Kobe, and this was Yokohama. And he was climbing up the stairs to his berth, and halfway up he had a laughing fit. And I couldn't quite figure out what had happened. And then when he came down again, I said, what happened? And she said she already had done her laundry, and she had strung across her berth bloomers, his size. And she practically fell down two ladders just laughing. And then one night everybody was seasick in that place. Thank you. And so we decided, since we learned that it's contagious, not to stay down there. And this young girl and another guy, my husband and I, took blankets and had a very nice night on deck first class, looking at the stars. And at that time there was not, you could be on first class even though we were traveling third class. And it said, if you walk so often around the deck, you have walked a mile. And there were English, young English people who very conscientiously walked a mile or more. And we were lying there. They just stepped over us, very happily walking, as they did their miles. And one day we were in the typhoon, and we were sitting at long tables for breakfast, and everybody had a very nice apple on his table. Everything went like this, and I got all the tables on my plate. And in all 11 days of this boat, my husband never got a pillow. There were swastikas all over. The food was terrible. They first fed the Japanese. Then they served scrambled eggs and breakfast for us, locked the doors, kept us waiting 15 minutes, and then let us eat very unpleasant 15-minute cold eggs. And so I was very happy. And then the ship stopped in Vancouver, but of course, this was English, and we were enemy aliens because we were on German passport, so we couldn't leave the boat, but we got mail. And we saw a little bit of Vancouver from the ship, and then we stopped off in Seattle and were a day there, and were treated by the Council of Jewish Women, who gave us hot chocolate and my first Hershey kiss. I had never seen Hershey kisses, and it was nice. And we saw Seattle, and in Seattle, I saw the first time in my life the black people looking exactly dressed like we did, because in my hometown you only saw them in the circus as very exotic looking, the wrinkles and all. And they would be stared because they had never seen it. And Seattle was beautiful. And then we decided to take the train from Seattle. At that time you didn't fly in 1940. And bus makes us seasick, so we decided to take the train from Seattle to New York, which was 3 nights and 4 days or something like it, and couldn't afford beds, so we just said, but since I'm short, I usually found an empty seat and curled up and slept quite nicely. I was very much impressed by their dining room. I saw my first baked potato. I'd never seen one. And also by the black waiter in the white jacket, looking very impressive. And then got to New York and moved in with some relatives who had come a year before us and were looking for jobs. And with all my great education, I wasn't trained to make any money, which proved to be a big problem. And I first took care of a little girl, and I wasn't great success there. And then I worked in a knitting store, where the people were very nice. I made $10 a week, 6 days a week, in the upper bunk. And we lived in Manhattan, near a medical center, about 170th Street, overlooking the Hudson. And I couldn't get over how beautiful that view was, the Hudson and the New Jersey. And there was a little park and the trees, because you always were told in Europe, oh, New York is nothing but stones, and you never see a tree, and you never see a plant. And it was really beautiful. And my husband got a job making dental instruments. I knew absolutely nothing about it. And I hope I never have a dentist who use them, because I hate to think how they turned out. And he started with $10 and then got a raise to $12 and then a raise to $14. And that shocked the boss so much that after 1 week of $14, the boss said, no, I can't afford it, you go back to $30, which enraged my husband enough to leave. And he then met some people who were interested in export, and he tried to build up his own connections in export. And I worked in a factory and sewing first bindings on panties, and then in another one making military kits to get the binding on. By then, this country was at war. It was after Pearl Harbor, and I was again an enemy alien here. I was fingerprinted. We had to give our camera to some authority. We were not allowed to have short-wave radios. And I was doing those kits, and I did it so badly that it was in half an hour. I had the whole machine in such a mess that they had to call for the boss to untangle me. And I thought maybe they are thinking I'm sabotaging their war effort, doing what I was doing. And then I expected my first child and retired from my great activities, and from then on our finances went very quickly very high up. My husband did very well in export and became vice president of a firm, and we bought, well, then I had in due course a daughter, a son and a daughter, and then the place in Manhattan was too small and we moved to Scottsdale. And the children and the section of Scottsdale we moved to had been restricted, which I didn't know, because I wouldn't have moved coming from Germany to anything restricted. But people were very unfriendly, and I was very unhappy, but that changed. And now I've been there 36 years in the same house, and I'm now the oldest on the block. I've not age-wise, but having lived there longer than anybody else. So then we had pretty good years in Scottsdale, and I needed some help because children were little and the house was big, and we had to do quite a lot of entertaining. My husband did export to South America and also traveled a lot. And so I heard about a German refugee woman who had emigrated to Holland and with her husband, and the husband died very young in Holland, and she was expecting and had a boy. And when this boy was about 5, the Nazis overtook Amsterdam and, of course, were trying to root up and kill the Jews. The Dutch people were very decent and were hiding many Jews and helped them. So this woman was hiding in an attic for 2 years, couldn't leave, and her son was taken over by poor Christian factory workers who had children of their own and just said one more won't make a difference and we pretend he is ours. Of course, all the neighbors knew that he really wasn't theirs, and in Germany they would have been denounced immediately. But the Dutch were very decent, and they both survived. And then we reunited when the boy was about 8, spoke only Dutch, and she spoke only German, but somehow they got together again. And then she and the son moved in with us. She was my housekeeper and the boy was brought up with my children. And went to school and learned English. And it worked out very nicely. And then in 55, my children were 8, 9 and 10. My husband passed away of a heart attack. He was only 45. And my first feeling was I'll take my children and move into an apartment with them. And then I had a very nice girlfriend who had a good head on her shoulders, and she said, how much money do you need a year? I had no idea. How much income do you have? No idea. Didn't know how to make out a check. My husband had done everything. And she said, all right, you sit down now and take care. So write down whatever you spend, whatever you get, and then we'll see what we'll do. And then we figured that was better for me to stay put financially. Plus, the children who had already suffered that terrible shock would have to go to a different school if I had moved, which would be another shock of separation from their friends, which I didn't want them to undergo. So I stayed put, and I'm very grateful to her that I did, because it was very good advice. So my children went to school and college and all do well, knock on wood. And in 68, I remarried, and my second husband had been a judge in Germany, and then was in England, and in 47, the English sent him as counsel, and he was a linguist, he was fluent in five languages, sent him as interpreter and counsel to the trials in Nuremberg for the war crimes. And he was there a year, and I have some pictures of that. And he had a daughter. So I had a fourth daughter. After I thought my youngest finally learned how to drive a car, and I was finished teaching them. And never again I found myself with a 16-year-old new daughter and started all over again. But we became very good friends and are very good friends. And she learned to drive, and she was a brilliant girl who had merit scholarships, and 10 colleges go to her to apply to them, and absolutely brilliant. And her father also was brilliant, I must say. And they all got on very well. My children loved him dearly, and he was very good to them. And then in due course, my children got married, and my older daughter got married in our house, and I forgot I came here, I'll say that later. Everything was ready for the wedding, and the bridesmaids was upstairs taking showers, and she was getting ready, and the groom had arrived, and my relatives had arrived, and suddenly it was dripping from the ceiling in the living room, over the couch where we sat, and over the fireplace where they wanted to have the ceremony. And I was totally helpless and ran to some neighbors, and I said, he was an engineer and very handy, and I said to him, someday I will laugh about it, but right now it's not funny. Is there anything you can do? It trip, trip, trip all over my living room, and about half an hour before the wedding. And so he came running, and he turned the water off, and I knew I had to get dressed, and he had to turn the water off in the bathroom next to my bedroom, and I didn't care that he was there. I have a one-track mind. If I have to get dressed, I get dressed. So regardless of what he was doing, I just changed into the other dress, and he was teasing me, of course, later. Then my son, in the meantime, Rabbi had arrived, and my son was sent downstairs to entertain the Rabbi while I was dressing. So he came up, and I said, how are things downstairs? Oh, it's going very well. The Rabbi is wiping the ceiling. So, but since he had turned it off, it stopped, and we later found out all those showers had come through. You know, the caulking around the top wasn't so good, and it came through the ceiling, and that did it. And from then on, the wedding was all right. And what I forgot to say was very important, that in 1956, I came here, hired by Brother Thomas for 3 weeks, which grew now into 27 and a half years. And I worked part-time because my children still came home for lunch, so I worked 9 to 12 or something, and he was wonderful to me. I had no idea what I worked in the library doing the typing the cards. I had no idea what a call number was, or a telephone number was, and but I was very well read. My parents instilled in me a great love for books. When I was 15, I had my own library cataloged of 400 books, fiction, that my own. And I always was a reader, and that, of course, was one of the great attractions to work in Ryan Library. And he was wonderful, and those years have stretched into 27 and a half. And I think that's about all I'm going to say. Well, I can say one more thing, that my husband has, my second husband has a brother who lives in California, and after World War I, people sent care packages to Europe because people really over there didn't have enough to eat, and he sent them to his hometown in Westphalia and started a correspondence with a girl there, out of which grew love and a marriage, and she came, I think he went over there, and then they got married, and she came here, and they lived in California, and now 30 years later. And my son's wedding also had a few difficulties, because it was December, and there was a blizzard. And they had decided, the girl came from Virginia, but since all the relatives were in Westchester, in New York, they decided to have the wedding in White Plains in my Jewish community center. So they were flying, the bride and mother and sister with gowns and everything wanted to fly on Saturday to New York for the Sunday wedding. And that Saturday the airports were closed because of the blizzard. So they had to come by bus, and she almost missed her own wedding. And the next day the best man missed it because his car was buried in so much snow that he couldn't make it. But they finally then came to the Hilton and for the food. And I think this is about what I wanted to say. And if anybody has any questions, I'd be very happy to, if I can, to answer them. Oh, my dating?
Yeah.
Okay. Two things. Okay, first this one. As I had said, went to, as an out student, to a convent school, and we had 7 o'clock curfew in the evening, which is very painful if you're 17 or 18, as I don't have to tell you. And I wanted to date, and my mother said, why don't you go out? The good sisters will not be out at 7 or 8, therefore it's not much the danger to be caught, which was true, and I dated. I went out, but we had also lay teachers because we were such an advanced course that not all the sisters could teach what we needed. And I was betrayed. This woman, English teacher, saw me with a guy in the cafe house and she denounced me. And that was the first only time in all my 12 years of school that I had a B in conduct. Always was A. And that was the one guy who bought me stiff anyway. So it was really twice painful. And the other time I went out with another guy and we went to a wine restaurant and I see my professor of chemistry come. And of course I shouldn't have been there, which I knew very well, but I was there. And so I didn't even have time to say anything. And to the surprise of my date, I suddenly disappeared under the table. There was a stand for the coat, professor, right behind our table. Professor came and hung up his coat very nicely, never saw me, because I was sitting under there. And then somehow or other we made our departure. And the third time I was also caught, but again by a man. Men are that way more decent, I think, than women. I was in another coffee house, and my math teacher came in, and we had advanced math, so my education actually is about 2 years of college. And we were studying the stars, the spheric. And so next day, he didn't say a word that he had seen me, but of course I knew. And he said to me, if this star stands there, and this star stands there, what happens? Well, I had as much idea as I assume you do, or the jerkers? None, absolutely none. And just hopefully said, then you don't see it. And he was laughing and he said, But you, Fräulein Rehbock, are seen in places where you shouldn't be seen. But he didn't denounce me. Yeah, and the other thing I wanted to say and forgot was, when I took this test, which was the end of my schooling, the first day you have to write an essay in German, just like here you would write in English. And you had two topics to choose from. And one was, I'm a German girl, a word of pride and obligation. And the other one I forgot. But my teacher was an SS man and came over immediately while I was looking at the two topics. And he said, Fräulein Rehbock, you cannot take this one because I'm not considered a German girl. So I took the other one, so I passed anyway. Now, any more questions? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Did you turn it over or it wasn't 45 minutes? Am I expired? Oh, well, unfortunately, when we were in Sweden, we tried to get my parents and my mother-in-law into Sweden. And for reasons not explained or known, the Swedish authorities permitted my mother-in-law to come, but not my parents. And my mother-in-law was in ill health and flatly refused to come without my parents. And so we never got them out. My father, I would almost say luckily, died in 1940 while we were on the ship coming here of a heart attack, and at home in his bed, had a massive heart attack, and the doctor lived right across the street that he was Christian. And my mother ran over, they were not allowed to have Jews were not allowed to have telephones at that time anymore. So she ran over and asked him to come, and he refused to come because it was a Jewish house, he wouldn't come. Mm-hmm. And my mother went through the public something or other telephone and got a Jewish that it was too late anyway. And my mother-in-law was a diabetic and needed a daily shot of insulin, and she was put into Theresienstadt, where I guess she survived a day at most and passed away. And my mother was deported with all the surviving Jews in my hometown about 1942. And then this was just before I had my child. My husband didn't tell me much about it. And they were all murdered. And I can't say exactly how. I assume in those gas chambers, but I'm not sure. All I know is that they all were murdered, and there were many men, women, children. Mm-hmm. Everybody, every Jew who was still in this little hometown.
Does anyone else have any experience of yours?
What about, does anyone else have dinners of Europe?
Are you,
madam?
No Europe. No connections
with Europe at all?
They were
all
born in the right place.
No.
But
this interests you.
Oh.
Any questions?
My father was in Germany. He was a Lutheran.
What
did
you say about your father?
My father was
Yeah. Where
Berlin.
From?
Berlin.
Berlin.
This is, he was born, I think he was 12 years old at the time of the war. Mm. So he was part of the Hitler Youth.
Of course. They all had to.
He, I guess he didn't, you know, he was kind of, he, I don't know what he has connected